The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, should we rethink the notion that space and time are governed by unwavering laws of nature? Are they better understood as habits themselves subject to change and evolution? Roberto Mangabeira Unger speaks to us about his new book with Lee Smolin, which insists that time applies to everything with all the far-reaching implications that has for the universe. Also on the show, we have our picks from the week's science news, including the announcement of Asteroid Day, the Google-backed genotyping service that can screen for common genetic diseases, and how the radiocarbon dating of mastodon fossils suggests the big beasts were driven from the Arctic regions by a cooling climate. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Roberto Mangabeira Unger is a philosopher and politician and the co-author with Lee Smolin of a new book, The Singular Universe and the Reality of Time. The book is a major attack on prevailing theories about the universe and its history and argues for cosmology to be led away from untestable speculations and back towards the disciplines of science. I spoke to Roberto Unger down the line from Boston, Massachusetts, and started by asking him what he was taking on here.
I have been collaborating with Lee Smolin now for 8 years. My interest in these matters is part of a general philosophical program of mine. And one way to describe that program is to say that it is an attempt to work out the assumptions under which many of our ideas about the world and about ourselves make sense. We moderns think that the world is for real, that time is real, that the new is possible in nature and in life, that history is open, and that the self, the person, has indefinite depth. But the assumptions under which these ideas make sense have not been spelled out. And thus, one of my ambitions in philosophy has been to work out systematically the ideas under which this self-understanding that we have would make sense. And that's what led me then, as part of this philosophical program, into natural philosophy, the philosophy of nature, and thus into cosmology, which is the science of the whole universe.
It seems in the book that you're taking quite a big issue with the state of modern cosmology. Where have scientists gone wrong?
Well, it's not clear that they've gone wrong. What there is confusion and crisis now in cosmology. The most important discovery of 20th century cosmology was the discovery that the universe has a history. And this discovery took place at a time when the most important general theories in 20th century physics, relativity and quantum mechanics, had already emerged. Both of them, relativity and quantum mechanics, are theories of the structure of the universe. And they arise from a tradition of science in which the object of science is to describe the permanent, even the eternal structure of nature. Then, after those theories had emerged, came the discovery that the universe is historical, that it has a history, that it evolves. And the relation between the discovery and the orientation to this abiding structure has yet to be fully elucidated. Now then, in the late 20th century, something else happened. A series of theories began to emerge in physics, like string theory in particle physics, that are compatible with many more forms of nature than the nature that we observe in the universe around us. Then an attempt was made to rescue these theories by saying that all the forms of nature that we do not see in the universe around us must exist in other universes that we do not observe. And thus, it's as if an explanatory failure had been converted into an explanatory triumph by a sleight of hand. And so science in cosmology risks descending into allegory or fabrication. And one of our objectives in this work is to rescue cosmology from this misdirection and dispense with this idea of a multitude of unobservable universes with which we do not have and cannot have any causal contact.
When you talk about that the universe has a history, I just want to be clear with our listeners what you mean by that. Are you talking about the discovery that the acceleration of the universe was expanding, or are you talking about the arrival or the kind of identification of forces splitting apart in the very early moments of the universe? For example, the electroweak force, you know, splitting into the weak and the electromagnetic force, things like that?
No, something very simple. The now standard cosmological model supposes that the universe began in a formative and explosive moment. But further, that the structure that we now see in our cooled-down universe once did not exist, or existed in a very different form. So that the basic typology, the catalog of types of things, studied at one level by the periodic table in chemistry and at another more fundamental level by particle physics, has a history, has a historical origin that was once different from what it now is. Now, that idea has revolutionary implications. The whole dominant tradition of science, the physics inaugurated by Galileo and by Newton, supposes that there is a permanent repertory of types of things in the world, and that this permanent repertory, this stock of natural kinds, is governed by unchanging laws of nature. That's the basic assumption of modern physics, and that assumption is incompatible with the view that everything in the universe changes sooner or later.
So you want to do away with the idea of the permanence of the natural laws, or the way the natural laws work, and also the idea of there being these unseen universes. Is that fair?
Well, we do want to reject both the idea that there is a permanent stock of natural kinds, of types of things, and that there are immutable laws, symmetries, and constants. But that against the background of a broader intellectual project that is organized around three sets of claims. The first claim is that there is only one real universe at a time. The second claim is that time is inclusively real, and that neither a permanent structure of nature nor permanent regularities of nature, the laws, symmetries, and supposed constants, are exempt from the reach of time. And third, that mathematics should be understood as a selective inquiry into the universe rather than as a prophetic view of the eternal structure of nature.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about this idea of time being inclusively real. And I think for some of our listeners, they may not be very familiar with some of the discussions going on in this particular area of physics and philosophy. But you have some people out there will talk about time being almost an illusion, an emergent property, rather than something that's real. But I wondered if you could take us through that. What do you mean by real as opposed to something else?
So let's begin with the simple idea of causation. Nothing is more important in science than causality. Causality presupposes time. A cause comes before its effect. In logic or in mathematics, a premise does not come before its conclusion. So our causal understanding assumes the reality of time. On the other hand, we think in this dominant tradition of modern physics that the laws of nature are written in the language of mathematics, and mathematics is outside time. So we have a mystery. How is it that ideas that are timeless can be so useful in the description of temporal nature? In the dominant tradition of thinking about causality, the tradition that has prevailed in modern philosophy, two ideas have been central. The first idea is causality is a construction of the mind. It's not a feature of nature. For example, Kant was one of the main architects of this idea in modern thought. And the second crucial assumption in this dominant tradition has been that all of our causal explanations formulated by the mind rely on immutable laws. So the laws serve as warrants of our causal explanations. In the course of this argument, we confront and attempt to replace both of those assumptions. And we take causality to be a fundamental or primitive feature of nature, which need not always take a law-like form. So now in the cool-down universe, in the universe around us, the universe that has evolved, causal relations are regular or recurrent. That is their law-like form. But nature, for example, in the very early universe, may have existed in forms in which causal relations did not appear in law-like form. They were, in a sense, lawless. So imagine the universe now, just for simplicity, for the sake of simplicity, in two moments. One is the moment of this universe around us, where there is a stable structure and stable regularities. But then there's the universe in its formative moments, the fiery moment of its formation, when all of these structures that we now observe did not exist in their differentiated form. And whatever regularities prevailed were not the regularities of the laws of nature that appear to govern the permanent structure now. There may have been no contrast between the states of affairs, the phenomena on the one hand, and the laws, symmetries, or constants. Nature can undergo these radical transformations. Now, we're actually familiar with that idea in other branches of science. For example, in biology, there we think that all of the types of things, for example, the species in natural evolution, may be mutable, may change. And we're also familiar in biology with the notion that the phenomena and the regularities may evolve simultaneously. But we have no tradition of applying these ideas in cosmology, in the study of the universe as a whole.
When it comes to your approach to the multiverse idea and arguing for the singular universe, and you talk about there being only one universe at a time, I wondered if you might define what you mean by universe in that sense. And are you rejecting the idea of part of a universe beyond what we can observe, or are you observing something slightly different, which would be parts of space and time beyond what we can observe, which have actually gone through other processes of inflation, for example, that might have different sort of natural laws going on within them?
No, of course, we have every reason to believe that the observed and observable universe is only a part, and even a small part, of the universe as a whole. But the criterion for defining what counts as a universe is causal connection. Not causal connection statically, but causal connection over time. So different phenomena are part of a universe if they share a history, such that at some point everything in this universe was in causal connection, even though it may later fall out of causal connection. The multiverse idea is something altogether different. It's the notion that there are many universes that were never in causal contact and cannot even in principle be observed or studied by us.
So you dismiss those in a sense because even if they are there, they do not count as our universe.
Well, they cannot be the object of science by definition. If we cannot observe them, if we cannot have any kind of empirical study that would explore or exploit their causal connection with us, they're not a proper element of the scientific study of nature. The reason why this conjecture was invented was that it served as part of a rescue operation. So we have these theories, I mentioned string theory, that are compatible with a multitude of unobserved variations of nature. And then we try and save these theories by saying, well, all the forms of nature that we do not observe must be realized in other universes. And thus arises this fabrication, this allegory of many universes, transmuting our failure into a triumph. And so we are dispensing, as it were, the enigmas, which should be the treasures of science, treating them as an embarrassment, and trying to save our theories by fabricating these hypothetical entities, the other unobserved universes. None of this is necessary to a scientific cosmology.
How do you think this happened? Is this something to do with human behavior, with a wish not to accept your theories wrong?
It's the desire that we have to save our theories. So physics entered this path of a combination of the string theories, compatible, as I said, with a multitude of unobserved forms of nature, then the multiverse conception with all of these other universes, and then what's called anthropic reasoning. So how do we explain the universe in which we find ourselves by thinking backward and saying it must have had the conditions that enabled us to exist? So all of this is a very dangerous path for science because it's a path that gets us away from the most important thing about the universe, simply that it is what it is, rather than something else. In this book, we cite a popular country western song that has the following line: "It is what it is, till it ain't anymore." And this line describes the two most important facts about nature. First, its factitious quality. It is what it is. And second, its temporal quality. Everything in nature changes.
Physicists really hate that idea of not being able to explain why our universe is the way it is. And as you were saying, when you bring in string theory, multiverses, you can then start looking to ideas of saying, well, all of these different possibilities are out there. We happen to be, and we would have to be in one region of space, one universe where life is possible and where intelligent life is possible. Does your thinking, with Lee Smolin's thinking, that view, bring us any closer to kind of solving some of these problems that physicists and cosmology have been grappling with, or does it raise even deeper puzzles about what's going on?
So first, it's not an abdication of explanatory ambition, of the attempt to explain things. On the contrary, it introduces the possibility that we can explain nature historically. Cosmology must be, in our view, a historical science. The reason why the universe is what it is that it was what it was. So once we develop this way of thinking and take it to the extreme, to the hilt, we can begin to have a way of answering the question, why are the laws of nature what they are, and why were the initial conditions of the universe what they were historically? On the other hand, we cannot do what a certain kind of philosopher, the rationalist metaphysician, wants to do, which is to show that the universe must be the way it is, because there are rational constraints that nature must obey. That's not a proper object of scientific ambition. So this multiverse idea that we were discussing before represents a kind of diluted rational metaphysics. It says, mathematics describes the ultimate structure of nature. Mathematics is compatible with many worlds. Therefore, all of these worlds must exist, even though we cannot observe them. That is a corruption of science and a misunderstanding of the relation of mathematics to natural science. So an important aspect of our work is a reconsideration of the relation of mathematics to nature and to natural science. One idea in that reconsideration is the following. Mathematics is not a study of imaginary entities, of a separate class of things. Mathematics is the study of the only world that exists, the world of nature, but under a special constraint, the constraint of sucking out from the world all of its natural particulars and its temporal character, time. So mathematics is a visionary exploration of a simulacrum of the world, a counterfeit version of the world, from which time and particularity have been sucked out. And it is useful to science precisely because it is so selective and limited.
Does the new approach come up with any predictions that can be tested? Are there any bones you can throw to cosmologists to say, look, I know this is going to come as bad news because what you've been working on for a long time may be misguided. If you try this, you may find yourself on more surer ground.
Well, both of us attempt to formulate the outline of an empirical agenda suggested by this way of thinking, especially Lee Smolin. In his part of the book, he places these arguments in the context of the agenda of contemporary physics and cosmology. So, to give you an example among many, these ideas are, we argue, compatible with the theory of inflation, that the universe had a super rapid expansion very early in its history. But they are not compatible with the theory of eternal inflation, that more universes keep being generated permanently out of this universe. So any evidence in favor of eternal inflation counts as evidence against these ideas.
Why do they rule out eternal inflation? Because in an evolving universe, everything changes, even so something wouldn't be eternal?
Eternal inflation has a strong affinity to the so-called steady state cosmologies. So there's a permanent process in nature in which nature keeps reproducing its basic character, its basic regularities, generating new copies of itself permanently. Most of them unobservable, no longer in causal contact with us. That's incompatible with the three ideas that are central to our conception here.
Roberto, it sounded as if you were saying that if you can find evidence for inflation, but not for eternal inflation, that may help your case, but I think I'm missing something.
No. It's that inflation is not incompatible with this view. So this view is compatible either with the existence or the non-existence of inflation, but it is not compatible with what is called eternal inflation. And therefore, any evidence in favor of eternal inflation is evidence against this view. Well, that's something that is being debated now. There are many defenders of internal inflation. Now, if we go back to the conception of the multiplicity of worlds, there is basically a choice to be made in cosmology between an idea of plurality of worlds and an idea of succession of universes. And within the idea of succession, there is in turn a choice to be made between the notion of cyclic succession and the notion of non-cyclic succession. So if there's a succession of worlds, the succession can be recurrent. The same regularities are maintained over time, and the same kinds of structures are generated. There are many theories of cyclic succession in contemporary cosmology. The argument that we develop in this work is in favor of non-cyclic succession. That is, history goes all the way down, and there is no structure in nature and no set of regularities that is immune to change. That's what it means for time to be inclusively real.
And that would make the future of the universe impossible to predict, right? Because there wouldn't be any regularity in how the laws are evolving.
The laws in the cool-down universe are very stable. Now, our argument in favor of non-cyclic succession generates a puzzle that we call the conundrum of the meta-laws. So we say, the regularities of nature evolve together, they co-evolve with the phenomena that they govern. Then it seems that we face a dilemma. One horn of this dilemma is to say that the transformation of the laws over time is itself governed by laws, higher order laws. And then we're caught in what seems to be an infinite regress, and we have reinstated in another form the notion of laws outside time. The other horn of the dilemma is to say, as you just suggested, that the transformation of the laws is not itself law governed and is therefore uncaused, and that too seems to be unacceptable. That's the conundrum of the meta laws. And one of our major concerns in this work is to confront that conundrum by suggesting a series of ways out of this quandary. Now, I would just say, coming from this subject as a social theorist, as a student of society and history, that we have confronted a similar problem in the study of society and of history. So you take Marxism, for example. It has the idea that there's a permanent list of types of social and economic organization, Marx's modes of production, and that there are laws governing the succession of these social regimes in history. Now, we no longer believe that there are these laws or that there is a permanent stock of indivisible systems, a menu of options in history. And a fear that existed in the evolution of social theory is that once we dispensed with this idea of laws of historical change, we would be thrown into agnosticism. We would have no way of understanding structural change in history. And we have come to see that we can dispense with this notion of higher order laws without being driven into historical agnosticism. That is a large part of the history of modern social theory. And now we confront, under this label of the conundrum of the meta-laws, a similar problem in our cosmological thinking.
And to be clear, how you nail that, how you say you confront it, how your solution is to say what?
We describe a series of elements that map out the space of a solution. We don't have a simple solution, but we have a range of ideas. Lee Smolin, in his part of the book, proposes two particular approaches to the conundrum of the meta loss, with which I disagree, and we explain in the book our disagreements. So he believes in what he calls cosmological natural selection, that universes that are prodigal in the formation of black holes tend to prevail in the evolution of nature. And then he has another approach that he calls the theory of precedence. Nature forms habits, and these habitual regularities tend to prevail over time. I take a different approach in my part of the book, and I argue that we should think of causality as a primitive feature of nature that ordinarily takes a law-like, regular, and recurrent form, but not always, and that there are extreme or violent forms of nature, as in the so-called Big Bang, but later also in the interior of black holes, where nature may not present itself in this law-like form. The regularities of nature evolve simultaneously. They co-evolve with the phenomena of nature. And in these extreme forms of nature, the distinction between the laws and the phenomena breaks down. No one should be troubled by being confused about these ideas. We're here dealing with the most difficult topic. The two most ambitious topics for thought are the understanding of ourselves and the understanding of the universe as a whole. And we see only a tiny patch of light in the midst of this surrounding darkness, but it's a tremendous affirmation of our power of transcendence over circumstance and limitation, that we can dare to address these issues.
A huge thanks to Roberto Unger there. The Singular Universe and the Reality of Time is published by Cambridge University Press and out in January.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
Let's look at some of the science stories making the news this week. I'm joined by Dr. Emily Grossman. Emily, what have you been looking at?
So I've been looking at the news story about the 23andMe, the genetic testing company that are offering a £125 test to get a personalised readout of your genetic code and the subsequent information about 100-odd genes and what they might mean. I say might, that basically the click of a switch, so to speak. So you spit in a little tube, you send it off to the Netherlands, it takes 6 to 8 weeks, and then they email you back with a printout of your genetic code and information about 43 specific disease genes, 11 risk factors for other genes, and some kind of weird and wonderful fun things as well, like why you do or don't like Brussels sprouts.
Do they actually interpret the information for you so you know what to make of it?
Well, that's the sort of contentious issue. Officially, no, they're saying it's not a diagnostic tool. It's an information-giving service as opposed to a medical screening service. They're interpreting the results to some extent, but they're not actually telling you what it really means or what to do about it. It's supposed to raise awareness so that everyday people can have an understanding of what their DNA is and what it might mean, and it's supposed to be a bit of fun. There's a lot of information in there as well about ancestry, so you can look at what percentage of your DNA is related to different tribes from different original countries and also to Neanderthals. So there's the fun element, which is what they're really pushing for, the interest element. Everyone has now a right to know what's in their code and what it could tell them about whether or not they flush when they drink alcohol or whether you like coriander. But there's also the serious side, which is there's 43 genetic diseases which are being screened for, such as cystic fibrosis, sickle cell anemia. And then there's 11 diseases where they're looking at elevated risk factors. And those are the ones that I think that are raising the most concern. I mean, the 43 genetic diseases, most people are probably quite likely to know if they have a genetic disease in their family. I mean, 1 in 22 of us are carriers for the cystic fibrosis recessive allele. So it's quite likely we may know if we've had someone in family have that. But on the other hand, if you don't know that, it may be useful to have that information. But it does kind of open the way to a sort of world where we could screen our potential partners for saying, oh, you know, are you the best possible genetic match? Because have you had your 23andMe screen done? But the main concern really from people in the field and from doctors who I've spoken to are these elevated risk factors. So they're screening for 11 genes that could confer a slight elevation of risk for things like heart disease, liver disease, Parkinson's, even Alzheimer's. And the concern is, well, what do you do about that information? What do you do with that information? My dad's actually a professor of endocrinology at Oxford University, and he deals with a lot of genetic diseases. And he said he wouldn't dream of doing a genetic screen for even one possible disease mutation without giving counselling and advice beforehand, revealing as to what might come out of the screen, and then discussing the screen afterwards, discussing what the results mean and where you go from there. And that's for something like a known disease mutation. With the elevated risk mutations that we're talking about, we're saying that the risk has maybe gone up by sort of 5% to the possibility of getting heart disease. If you were then to take that to someone like him or even a GP, they're unlikely to know what you're going to do with that information. You know, what are they going to tell you? That, oh, just do a bit more exercise, cut down on your cholesterol, stop smoking, eat more healthily. It's not saying you're going to get this disease. It's saying you have a slightly higher risk. And most doctors, even like him dealing with genetic diseases, aren't going to be able to say this is what you need to do about it and this is what's going to happen. So the concern is it's just going to increase anxiety. There's going to be a lot of concerned people out there going to their doctors, going to their GPs and saying, I've been told I've got a higher risk of dementia. What do I do about it? Well, with something like dementia, the point is there is nothing you can do. So then are there just going to be a lot of concerned people saying, oh gosh, you know, am I more likely to get this? Is there going to be neurosis and anxiety around it? When there's actually nothing really that's known that can be done. And there's very few trained geneticists out there. Of course, there are geneticists, but you'd need a very highly trained geneticist to understand the information. The point is that genetics is very complicated. Mm. It's not just a case of, oh, you've got this mutation, therefore you're going to get a disease. What do we do with it other than raise alarm and raise concern? And a good point's been made in the press on it is that the NHS are actually in the middle of a scheme where they're screening 100,000 genomes of people with diseases, particularly 40,000 of people with cancer, to look at the first large-scale sequencing of DNA and looking at patterns, looking at disease mutations. And the pilot scheme of that is well underway, and it's supposed to be done by 2017. And that's going to give, I think, a much safer, more responsible handout of information, and they're looking at how best to use that information to treat diseases and to look for medications and to look for potential cures or prophylaxis for disease. And that's going to be available. So the technology is there. And yes, we need to keep up with that, but it's whether we trust a privatized company backed by Google or whether we wait and allow the NHS to do it in a way that's a more responsible way of looking at it.
But it does seem kind of irresponsible. I mean, because they're not even looking at the whole genome. They're looking at a small number of cards in the deck that we get dealt and giving you information on those for which the information is incomplete. Mm-hmm. And even if they're not doing the interpretation themselves, it's pretty clear that people will then infer stuff from that, or they will go on the internet and find out all sorts of things. And you wonder exactly what the sort of impact of that is going to be. It's going to be an interesting one to follow to see what really comes from it.
Exactly. And as you say, it's an incomplete picture because all genes interact with each other. That's one of the most important things that's come out in recent times, is that so much of our DNA doesn't actually code for stuff, but there's so much interaction between all the genes. We have almost identical DNA to monkeys, but the reason that we're so much more complex is because our genes and our protein products of the genes all interact with each other, and that's what defines how we come out. So just because one person has a mutation in something doesn't mean that their body will manifest it in even remotely a similar way to another person. And without knowing all of the rest of the information and all of the rest of the interactions, it's a very, very complicated situation that we just can't predict what's going to happen or what to do about it.
And what about the accuracy of these tests? Are they actually pretty consistent?
Well, that's a really crucial point, actually, because no test is 100% accurate. It's just not. And it's not known how reliable these tests are. So you could get a readout telling you you've got a particular disease mutation for a particular gene. It may not actually be true, and that could raise a huge amount of alarm. You know, if it was a breast cancer mutation, prophylaxis is removing a breast. And if that's not actually a true result, that can cause a huge amount of trauma. On the other hand, you also get results coming through that say you're normal for a mutation and actually you're not. And in the absence of real medical tests, if you think you're at risk, if you're relying on one of these private tests to give you a result and then it says you're fine, and actually the truth is you're not, you may actually miss something as well. So I think there's a real danger in relying on this when we don't know how accurate the data is. And no test anyway can be 100% reliable. You always need backups.
And it's worth saying that 23andMe were prohibited from doing interpretation of the genetic tests they were doing in the US.
Yeah.
So over here, they're presumably still making the money, still offering the test, but they're framing it in a different way.
Exactly. The FDA in America issued a warning a year ago and said that they weren't to market this test for anything to do with health, that it was only to be marketed for ancestry analysis, so looking at what percentage Neanderthal you are. But they weren't allowed to do any health screens with it. They were allowed to give a readout of the genetic code, but not interpret it in any way in terms of health. They're quoted to have said that they've changed the test and they've backed a little bit away from health and diagnostics, and they've moved more towards just simple information giving. But then it does make me wonder, well, what exactly are they doing differently? And if the FDA banned it in America a year ago, and America are generally quite open to new things and quite sort of commercial like that, if they banned it there, the concern is, well, why are we allowing it here?
And it's available in the UK from when?
The press came out on it on Tuesday and it was saying from today.
Okay.
From today. So £125 you can send off for a complete readout from the Netherlands. Scientists from around the world have joined forces to combat the existential threat posed by an asteroid strike with plans for a live concert and an awareness day. Ian, tell us about that.
So this is Asteroid Day, which is a project, if you like, set up by some entertainers, people like Brian May from Queen, also an astrophysicist, of course. Brian Cox is there, Richard Dawkins is there, Sir Martin Rees is there, the Astronomer Royal, and some former NASA astronauts and so on. What they want to do is have the 30th of June next year, which is the anniversary of the Tunguska event in Russia, in Siberia, which was an air blast over the ground from an asteroid coming in or a space rock coming in, detonating. They want to have an awareness day for the kind of existential threat that is posed by incoming asteroids, meteorites, whatever we want to call them, as they come in and hit us. And they are calling really for, as well as this awareness day where they want to have some concerts and a lot of different events going on, they want to get governments and philanthropists, private companies to start putting more effort into the search for these sort of bodies that might hit us, these near-Earth objects, as we'll call them. And at the moment, we're finding them pretty consistently, but fairly slowly. I think we've discovered probably about 1% of the asteroids that could cause a big problem if they were to hit Earth, that could cause major kind of destruction. And they want to ramp that up 100-fold to ensure that we get down to a much smaller size. Should we spot something coming in, that we may be able to do something about it. And there are, if you think about what happened over Tunguska in Siberia in 1908, this was about an 80-meter diameter lump of rock that came in and it exploded in the air as it entered the atmosphere. And that flattened 2,000 square kilometers of conifer forest. And if that happened over London, that force at least would be felt within the whole of the M25. And so you can imagine the sort of the destructive power. And at the moment, it's incredibly difficult to see asteroids that are that small. You can't really pick them up yet, although there are projects in line in the pipeline to try and find asteroids getting towards that size. But at the moment, there are much bigger ones, which are still problematic. The work also wants to look at what do you do if you find one coming in? Because, you know, we can have all these sort of Hollywood scenarios of going up there, drilling holes in them and putting nuclear bombs in them and trying to set them off. But just to look at the Rosetta mission and seeing how difficult it is to put a lander onto a comet, let alone getting astronauts up there with drilling equipment and bombs, it's a tough thing to do. And some of these asteroids are incredibly rich in iron, and you could probably drill a hole and put a nuclear bomb in it and set it off, and it may not make much difference to the asteroid apart from sort of hollow out a hole in the middle. So there are different technologies being looked at to slightly nudge them off course. I mean, some of them are fairly blunt. You just drive a spacecraft into it and hope that the spacecraft is massive enough that it causes even a minute but a deflection, such that if you do it early enough, you may be able to push it on off a collision course with Earth. But you obviously have to know the trajectories and the orbits of these things incredibly well to make sure you don't make a bad situation worse by changing a near miss into a direct hit. So come June next year, we'll be seeing what comes of all of this and seeing if any of the governments or private companies actually step up to the plate and really start putting more effort in. Radiocarbon dating of fossils suggests that mastodons, the relatives of modern elephants, were driven from North America's Arctic regions by a cooling climate. Emily, tell us more about this one.
So it's been thought until recently that the reason that these prehistoric elephants called mastodons became extinct is because of hunting by humans, because it was thought that they came into extinction about 10,000 years ago, which corresponds with the time at which humans arrived in North America. Now, new radiocarbon techniques of dating of the fossils has actually shown that most of the fossils from these elephants are over 50,000 years old, probably more towards 75,000 years old. So it's thought that something else must have driven them to extinction, because most of them were pretty much gone by the time the humans came. And what they feel it is that 75,000 years ago, North America was in an interglacial period where, instead of sort of cold freezing conditions like it is now, it was forests and wetlands, good conditions for these elephants to live in, along with other what's so-called megafauna like saber-toothed tigers and wild sloths that are also brought about for probably similar reasons to extinction. After 75,000 years ago, climate change then created another Arctic period where the glaciers came in, and it's thought that the mastodons then moved southwards looking for warmer climates. They spread out. A lot of them will have died en route and in the cold conditions. And actually, by the time the humans came along, about 10,000 years ago, there were so few of them around already that then hunting just kind of pushed them over the brink. That was the final straw, and that's what killed them. So, in fact, it seems that humans were less to blame for the extinction of most of the mastodons and probably also the rest of the megafauna, the saber-toothed tigers and the wild sloths.
So what's new about this technique?
Well, this technique of radiocarbon dating actually used the collagen in the bones as opposed to other parts of the bones for the dating technique. And the benefit of that was that previously there were artifacts in the bones, such as glue and varnish, that were used to strengthen the fossils that were interfering with the results. By using just the collagen, they've removed those artifacts and the effect on the results, and they've actually found that the bones, the fossils, these 36 fossils they looked at, which were the teeth and the bones that were found in Alaska and Yukon in North America, that these fossils were actually a lot older than previously thought. They were over 50,000 years old. It's not known exactly how old, because 50,000 years is about the limit of what we can look at with radiocarbon dating. Any older than that, and it's hard to tell.
That's all we have for you this week. A big thanks to Roberto Mangabeira Unger and Emily Grossman. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.